Hello and welcome. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time. This week, we bring you Drink and Death from Winesburg, Ohio, by Sherwood Anderson. Not the most cheerful topics. I've received feedback from my listeners that these stories are very grim. Yes, I guess they can seem that way. To that, I quote Khadija Khan at Sparks of Her. Today, when we sugarcoat fictions so pink that the black reality hurts like pointed straw in our heels. Can it be that modern fiction is so pink that when we hear stories too close to reality, it makes us truly uncomfortable? That raw reality is painful? If that's the case, it only deepens my conviction to put these stories out there. My goal has always been to rattle you, enlighten you, touch you, to pierce your armor and open your heart. If these stories do that, I'm glad. And now, Drink, concerning Tom Foster. Tom Foster came to Winesburg from Cincinnati when he was still young and could get many new impressions. His grandmother had been raised on a farm near the town, and as a young girl had gone to school there, when Winesburg was a village of 12 or 15 houses, clustered about a general store on the Trunion Pike. What a life the old woman had led since she went away from the frontier settlement, and what a strong, capable little old thing she was. She had been in Kansas, in Canada, and in New York City, traveling about with her husband, a mechanic, before he died. Later, she went to stay with her daughter, who had also married a mechanic, and lived in Covington, Kentucky, across the river from Cincinnati. Then began the hard years for Tom Foster's grandmother. First, her son-in-law was killed by a policeman during a strike, and then Tom's mother became an invalid and died also. The grandmother had saved a little money, but it was swept away by the illness of the daughter and by the cost of the two funerals. She became a half-worn-out old woman worker and lived with the grandson above a junk shop on a side street in Cincinnati. For 5 years, she scrubbed the floors in an office building and then got a place as dishwasher in a restaurant. Her hands were all twisted out of shape. When she took hold of a mop or a broom handle, the hands looked like the dried stems of an old creeping vine clinging to a tree. The old woman came back to Winesburg as soon as she got the chance. One evening, as she was coming home from work, she found a pocketbook containing $37, and that opened the way. The trip was a great adventure for the boy. It was past 7 o'clock at night when the grandmother came home with the pocketbook held tightly in her old hands, and she was so excited she could scarcely speak. She insisted on leaving Cincinnati that night, saying that if they stayed until morning, the owner of the money would be sure to find them out and make trouble. Tom, who was then 16 years old, had to go trudging off to the station with the old woman, bearing all of their earthly belongings done up in a worn-out blanket and slung across his back. By his side walked the grandmother, urging him forward. Her toothless old mouth twitched nervously, and when Tom grew weary and wanted to put the pack down at a street crossing, she snatched it up, and if he had not prevented, would have slung it across her own back. When they got into the train and it had run out of the city, she was as delighted as a girl and talked as the boy had never heard her talk before. All through the night, as the train rattled along, the grandmother told Tom tales of Winesburg and of how he would enjoy his life, working in the fields and shooting wild things in the woods there. She could not believe that the tiny village of 50 years before had grown into a thriving town in her absence, and in the morning, when the train came to Winesburg, did not want to get off.
"It isn't what I thought. It may be hard for you here," she said.
And then the train went on its way, and the two stood confused, not knowing where to turn, in the presence of Albert Longworth, the Winesburg baggage master. But Tom Foster did get along all right. He was one to get along anywhere. Mrs. White, the banker's wife, employed his grandmother to work in the kitchen, and he got a place as stable boy in the banker's new brick barn. In Winesburg, servants were hard to get. The woman who wanted help in her housework employed a hired girl who insisted on sitting at the table with the family. Mrs. White was sick of hired girls and snatched at the chance to get hold of the old city woman. She furnished a room for the boy, Tom, upstairs in the barn. "He can mow the lawn and run errands when the horses do not need attention," she explained to her husband. Tom Foster was rather small for his age and had a large head covered with stiff black hair that stood straight up. The hair emphasized the bigness of his head. His voice was the softest thing imaginable, and he was himself so gentle and quiet that he slipped into the life of the town without attracting the least bit of attention. One could not help wondering where Tom Foster got his gentleness. In Cincinnati, he had lived in a neighborhood where gangs of tough boys prowled through the streets, and all through his early informative years, he ran about with tough boys. For a while, he was a messenger for a telegraph company and delivered messages in a neighborhood sprinkled with houses of prostitution. The women in the houses knew and loved Tom Foster, and the tough boys in the gangs loved him also. He never asserted himself. That was one thing that helped him escape. In an odd way, he stood in the shadow of the wall of life, was meant to stand in the shadow. He saw the men and women in the houses of lust, sensed their casual and horrible love affairs, saw boys fighting, and listened to their tales of thieving and drunkenness, unmoved and strangely unaffected. Once, Tom did steal. That was while he was still living in the city. The grandmother was ill at the time, and he himself was out of work. There was nothing to eat in the house, and so he went into a harness shop on a side street and stole $1.75 out of the cash drawer. The harness shop was run by an old man with a long mustache. He saw the boy lurking about and thought nothing of it. When he went out into the street to talk to a teamster, Tom opened the cash drawer and, taking the money, walked away. Later, he was caught, and his grandmother settled the matter by offering to come twice a week for a month and scrub the shop. The boy was ashamed, but he was rather glad, too. "It is all right to be ashamed, and makes me understand new things," he said to his grandmother, who didn't know what the boy was talking about, but loved him so much that it didn't matter whether she understood or not. For a year, Tom Foster lived in the banker's stable and then lost his place there. He didn't take very good care of the horses, and he was a constant source of irritation to the banker's wife. She told him to mow the lawn, and he forgot. Then she sent him to the store or the post office, and he did not come back, but joined a group of men and boys and spent the whole afternoon with them, standing about, listening, and occasionally, when addressed, saying a few words. As in the city, in the houses of prostitution, and with the rowdy boys running through the streets at night, so in Winesburg, among its citizens, he had always the power to be a part of, and yet distinctly apart from the life about him. After Tom lost his place at Banker White's, he did not live with his grandmother, although often in the evening she came to visit him. He rented a room at the rear of a little frame building belonging to old Rufus Whiting. The building was on Duane Street, just off Main Street, and had been used for years as a law office by the old man, who had become too feeble and forgetful for the practice of his profession, but did not realize his inefficiency. He liked Tom, and let him have the room for $1 a month. In the late afternoon, when the lawyer had gone home, the boy had the place to himself and spent hours lying on the floor by the stove and thinking of things. In the evening, the grandmother came and sat in the lawyer's chair to smoke a pipe, while Tom remained silent, as he always did in the presence of everyone. Often the old woman talked with great vigor. Sometimes she was angry about something happening at the banker's house and scolded away for hours. Out of her own earnings, she bought a mop and regularly scrubbed the lawyer's office. Then, when the place was spotlessly clean and smelled clean, she lighted her clay pipe, and she and Tom had a smoke together.
"When you get ready to die, then I will die also," she said to the boy lying on the floor beside her chair.
Tom Foster enjoyed life in Winesburg. He did odd jobs, such as cutting wood for kitchen stoves and mowing the grass before houses. In late May and early June, he picked strawberries in the fields. He had time to loaf, and he enjoyed loafing. Banker White had given him a cast-off coat, which was too large for him, but his grandmother cut it down. And he also had an overcoat, got at the same place, that was lined with fur. The fur was worn away in spots, but the coat was warm, and in the winter Tom slept in it. He thought his method of getting along good enough, and was happy and satisfied with the way life in Winesburg had turned out for him. The most absurd little things made Tom Foster happy. That, I suppose, was why people loved him. In Hearn's Grocery, they would be roasting coffee on Friday afternoon, preparatory to the Saturday rush of trade, and the rich odor invaded Lower Main Street. Tom Foster appeared and sat on a box at the rear of the store. For an hour, he did not move, but sat perfectly still, filling his being with the spicy odor that made him half drunk with happiness.
"I like it," he said gently. "It makes me think of things far away, places and things like that."
One night, Tom Foster got drunk. That came about in a curious way. He never had been drunk before, and indeed, in all his life, had never taken a drink of anything intoxicating. But he felt he needed to be drunk that one time, and so went and did it. In Cincinnati, when he lived there, Tom had found out many things, things about ugliness and crime and lust. Indeed, he knew more of these things than anyone else in Winesburg. The matter of sex in particular had presented itself to him in quite a horrible way and had made a deep impression on his mind. He thought, after what he had seen of the women standing before the squalid houses on cold nights, and the look he had seen in the eyes of the men who stopped to talk to them, that he would put sex altogether out of his own life. One of the women of the neighborhood tempted him once, and he went into a room with her. He never forgot the smell of the room, nor the greedy look that came into the eyes of the woman. It sickened him, and in a very terrible way left a scar on his soul. He had always before thought of women as quite innocent things, much like his grandmother. But after that one experience in the room, he dismissed women from his mind. So gentle was his nature that he could not hate anything, and not being able to understand, he decided to forget. And Tom did forget, until he came to Winesburg. After he had lived there for 2 years, something began to stir in him. On all sides, he saw youth making love, and he was himself a youth. Before he knew what had happened, he was in love also. He fell in love with Helen White, daughter of the man for whom he had worked, and found himself thinking of her at night. That was a problem for Tom, and he settled it in his own way. He let himself think of Helen White whenever her figure came into his mind, and only concerned himself with the manner of his thoughts. He had a fight, a quite determined little fight of his own, to keep his desires in the channel where he thought they belonged, but on the whole, he was victorious. And then came the spring night when he got drunk. Tom was wild on that night. He was like an innocent young buck of the forest that had eaten of some maddening weed. The thing began, ran its course, and was ended in one night, and you may be sure that no one in Winesburg was any the worse for Tom's outbreak. In the first place, the night was one to make a sensitive nature drunk. The trees along the resident streets of the town were all newly clothed in soft green leaves. In the gardens behind the houses, men were puttering about in vegetable gardens. And in the air, there was a hush, a waiting kind of silence, very stirring to the blood. Tom left his room on Duane Street just as the young night began to make itself felt. First, he walked through the streets, going softly and quietly along, thinking thoughts that he tried to put into words. He said that Helen White was a flame dancing in the air, and that he was a little tree without leaves, standing out sharply against the sky. Then he said she was a wind, a strong, terrible wind, coming out of the darkness of a stormy sea, and that he was a boat left on the shore of the sea by a fisherman. That idea pleased the boy, and he sauntered along playing with it. He went into Main Street and sat on the curbing before Wacker's tobacco shop. For an hour he lingered about listening to the talk of men, but it did not interest him much, and he slipped away. Then he decided to get drunk, and went into Willie's saloon and bought a bottle of whiskey. Putting the bottle into his pocket, he walked out of town, wanting to be alone to think more thoughts and to drink the whiskey. Tom got drunk, sitting on a bank of new grass beside the road about a mile north of town. Before him was a white road, and at his back an apple orchard in full bloom. He took a drink out of the bottle, and then lay down on the grass. He thought of mornings in Winesburg, and of how the stones in the gravel driveway of Banker White's house were wet with dew and glistened in the morning light. He thought of the nights in the barn when it rained, and he lay awake hearing the drumming of the raindrops and smelling the warm smell of horses and of hay. Then he thought of a storm that had gone roaring through Winesburg several days before, and his mind going back, he relived the night he had spent on the train with his grandmother when the two were coming from Cincinnati. Sharply, he remembered how strange it had seemed to sit quietly in the coach and to feel the power of the engine hurling the train along through the night. Tom got drunk in a very short time. He kept taking drinks from the bottle as the thoughts visited him, and when his head began to reel, got up and walked along the road going away from Winesburg. There was a bridge on the road that ran out of Winesburg north to Lake Erie, and the drunken boy made his way along the road to the bridge. There he sat down. He tried to drink again, but when he had taken the cork out of the bottle, he became ill and put it quickly back. His head was rocking back and forth, so he sat on the stone approach to the bridge and sighed. His head seemed to be flying about like a pinwheel, and then projecting itself off into space, and his arms and legs flopped helplessly about. At 11 o'clock, Tom got back into town. George Willard found him wandering about and took him into the Eagle print shop. Then he became afraid that the drunk boy would make a mess on the floor and helped him into the alleyway. The reporter was confused by Tom Foster. The drunken boy talked of Helen White and said he had been with her on the shore of a sea and had made love to her. George had seen Helen White walking in the street with her father during the evening and decided that Tom was out of his head. A sentiment concerning Helen White that lurked in his own heart flamed up and he became angry. "Now you quit that," he said. "I won't let Helen White's name be dragged into this. I won't let that happen." He began shaking Tom's shoulder, trying to make him understand. "You quit it," he said again. For 3 hours, the two young men, thus strangely thrown together, stayed in the print shop. When he had a little recovered, George took Tom for a walk. They went into the country and sat on a log near the edge of a wood. Something in the still night drew them together, and when the drunken boy's head began to clear, they talked. "It was good to be drunk," Tom Foster said. "It taught me something. I won't have to do it again. I will think more dearly after this. You see how it is." George Willard did not see, but his anger concerning Helen White passed, and he felt drawn toward the pale, shaken boy as he had never before been drawn toward anyone. With motherly solicitude, he insisted that Tom get to his feet and walk about. Again, they went back to the print shop and sat in silence in the darkness. The reporter could not get the purpose of Tom Foster's action straightened out in his mind. When Tom spoke again of Helen White, he again grew angry and began to scold.
You quit that, he said sharply. You haven't been with her. What makes you say you have? What makes you keep saying such things? Now you quit it, do you hear?
Tom was hurt. He couldn't quarrel with George Willard because he was incapable of quarreling, so he got up to go away. When George Willard was insistent, he put out his hand, laying it on the older boy's arm, and tried to explain.
Well, he said softly, I don't know how it was. I was happy. You see how that was? Helen White made me happy, and the night did too. I wanted to suffer, to be hurt somehow. I thought that was what I should do. I wanted to suffer, you see, because everyone suffers and does wrong. I thought of a lot of things to do, but they wouldn't work. They all hurt someone else.
Tom Foster's voice arose, and for once in his life he became almost excited.
It was like making love, that's what I mean, he explained. Don't you see how it is? It hurt me to do what I did and made everything strange. That's why I did it. I'm glad, too. It taught me something, that's it. That's what I wanted. Don't you understand? I wanted to learn things, you see? That's why I did it.
And now, death. Concerning Dr. Reefy and Elizabeth Willard. The stairway leading up to Dr. Reefy's office in Hefner Block above the Paris dry goods store was but dimly lighted. At the head of the stairway hung a lamp with a dirty chimney that was fastened by a bracket to the wall. The lamp had a tin reflector, brown with rust and covered with dust. The people who went up the stairway followed with their feet the feet of many who had gone before. The soft boards of the stairs had yielded under the pressure of feet, and deep hollows marked the way. At the top of the stairway, a turn to the right brought you to the doctor's door. To the left was a dark hallway filled with rubbish. Old chairs, carpenter's horses, stepladders, and empty boxes lay in the darkness, waiting for shins to be barked. The pile of rubbish belonged to the Paris Dry Goods Company. When a counter or a row of shelves in the store became useless, clerks carried it up the stairway and threw it on the pile. Dr. Reefy's office was as large as a barn. A stove with a round paunch sat in the middle of the room. Around its base was piled sawdust, held in place by heavy planks nailed to the floor. By the door stood a huge table that had once been part of the furniture of Herrick's clothing store and had been used for displaying custom-made clothes. It was covered with books, bottles, and surgical instruments. Near the edge of the table lay three or four apples left by John Spaniard, a tree nurseryman who was Dr. Reefy's friend, and who had slipped the apples out of his pocket as he came in at the door. At middle age, Dr. Reefy was tall and awkward. The gray beard he later wore had not yet appeared, but on the upper lip grew a brown mustache. He was not a graceful man, as when he grew older, and was much occupied with the problem of disposing of his hands and feet. On summer afternoons, when she had been married many years and when her son George was a boy of 12 or 14, Elizabeth Willard sometimes went up the worn steps to Dr. Reefy's office. Already the woman's naturally tall figure had begun to droop and to drag itself listlessly about. Ostensibly, she went to see the doctor because of her health, but on the half-dozen occasions when she had been to see him, the outcome of the visit did not primarily concern her health. She and the doctor talked of that, but they talked most of her life, of their two lives, and of the ideas that had come to them as they lived their lives in Winesburg. In the big, empty office, the man and the woman sat looking at each other, and they were a good deal alike. Their bodies were different, as were also the color of their eyes, the length of their noses, and the circumstances of their existence. But something inside them meant the same thing, wanted the same release, would have left the same impression on the memory of an onlooker. Later, when he grew older and married a young wife, The doctor often talked to her of hours spent with the sick woman and expressed a good many things he had been unable to express to Elizabeth. He was almost a poet in his old age, and his notion of what happened took a poetic turn.
I had come to the time in my life when prayer became necessary, and so I invented gods and prayed to them, he said. I did not say my prayers in words, nor did I kneel down, but sat perfectly still in my chair. In the late afternoon, when it was hot and quiet on Main Street, or in the winter when the days were gloomy, the gods came into the office, and I thought no one knew about them. Then I found that this woman Elizabeth knew, that she worshipped also the same gods. I have a notion that she came to the office because she thought the gods would be there. But she was happy to find herself not alone just the same. It was an experience that cannot be explained, although I suppose it is always happening to men and women in all sorts of places. On the summer afternoons when Elizabeth and the doctor sat in the office and talked of their two lives, they talked of other lives also. Sometimes the doctor made philosophic epigrams. Then he chuckled with amusement. Now and then, after a period of silence, a word was said or a hint given that strangely illuminated the life of the speaker. A wish became a desire, or a dream, half dead, flared suddenly into life. For the most part, the words came from the woman, and she said them without looking at the man. Each time she came to see the doctor, the hotel keeper's wife talked a little more freely, and after an hour or two in his presence, went down the stairway into Main Street, feeling renewed and strengthened against the dullness of her days. With something approaching a girlhood swing to her body, she walked along. But when she got back to her chair by the window of her room, and when darkness had come on, and a girl from the hotel dining room brought her dinner on a tray, she let it grow cold. Her thoughts ran away to her girlhood with a passionate longing for adventure, and she remembered the arms of men that had held her when adventure was a possible thing for her. Particularly, she remembered one who had for a time been her lover, and who, in the moment of his passion, had cried out to her more than 100 times, saying the same words madly over and over, "You dear, you dear, you lovely dear." The words, she thought, expressed something she would have liked to have achieved in life. In her room, in the shabby old hotel, the sick wife of the hotel keeper began to weep, and putting her hands to her face, rocked back and forth. The words of her one friend, Dr. Reefy, rang in her ears. "Love is like a wind stirring the grass beneath trees on a black night," he had said. "You must not try to make love definite. It is the divine accident of life. If you try to be definite and sure about it, and to live beneath the trees where soft night winds blow, the long hot day of disappointment comes swiftly, and the gritty dust from passing wagons gathers upon lips inflamed and made tender by kisses." Elizabeth Willard could not remember her mother, who had died when she was but 5 years old. Her girlhood had been lived in the most haphazard manner imaginable. Her father was a man who had wanted to be let alone, and the affairs of the hotel would not let him alone. He also had lived and died a sick man. Every day he arose with a cheerful face, but by 10 o'clock in the morning, all the joy had gone out of his heart. When a guest complained of the fare in the hotel dining room, or one of the girls who made up the beds got married and went away, he stamped on the floor and swore. At night, when he went to bed, he thought of his daughter growing up among the stream of people that drifted in and out of the hotel, and was overcome with sadness. As the girl grew older and began to walk out in the evening with men, he wanted to talk to her, but when he tried, was not successful. He always forgot what he wanted to say, and spent the time complaining of his own affairs. In her girlhood and young womanhood, Elizabeth had tried to be a real adventurer in life. At 18, life had so gripped her that she was no longer a virgin,
But although she had a half-dozen lovers before she married Tom Willard, she had never entered upon an adventure prompted by desire alone. Like all the women in the world, she wanted a real lover. Always there was something she sought blindly, passionately, some hidden wonder in life. The tall, beautiful girl with the swinging stride who had walked under the trees with men was forever putting out her hand into the darkness and trying to get hold of some other hand. In all the babble of words that fell from the lips of the men with whom she had ventured, she was trying to find what would be for her the true word. Elizabeth had married Tom Willard, a clerk in her father's hotel, because he was at hand and wanted to marry at the time when the determination to marry came to her. For a while, like most young girls, she thought marriage would change the face of life. If there was in her mind a doubt of the outcome of the marriage with Tom, she brushed it aside. Her father was ill and near death at the time, and she was perplexed because of the meaningless outcome of an affair in which she had just been involved. Other girls of her age in Winesburg were marrying men she had always known, grocery clerks or young farmers. In the evening when they walked in Main Street with their husbands, and when she passed they smiled happily. She began to think that the fact of marriage might be full of some hidden significance. Young wives with whom she talked spoke softly and shyly. "It changes things to have a man of your own," they said. On the evening before her marriage, the perplexed girl had a talk with her father. Later, she wondered if the hours alone with the sick man had not led to her decision to marry. The father talked of his life and advised the daughter to avoid being led into another such muddle. He abused Tom Willard, and that led Elizabeth to come to the clerk's defense. The sick man became excited and tried to get out of bed. When she would not let him walk about, he began to complain.
"I've never been let alone," he said. "Although I've worked hard, I've not made the hotel pay. Even now I owe money at the bank. You'll find that out when I'm gone."
The voice of the sick man became tense with earnestness. Being unable to arise, he put out his hand and pulled the girl's head down beside his own.
"There's a way out," he whispered. "Don't marry Tom Willard or anyone else here in Winesburg. There's $800 in a tin box in my trunk. Take it and go away."
Again, the sick man's voice became querulous.
"You've got to promise," he declared. "If you won't promise not to marry, give me your word that you'll never tell Tom about the money. It is mine, and if I give it to you, I've the right to make that demand. Hide it away. It is to make up to you for my failure as a father. Sometime it may prove to be a door, a great open door to you. Come now. I tell you I'm about to die. Give me your promise."
In Dr. Reefy's office, Elizabeth, a tired, gaunt old woman at 41, sat in a chair near the stove and looked at the floor. By a small desk near the window sat the doctor. His hands played with a lead pencil that lay on the desk. Elizabeth talked of her life as a married woman. She became impersonal and forgot her husband, only using him as a lay figure to give point to her tale.
"And then I was married, and it did not turn out at all," she said bitterly. "As soon as I had gone into it, I began to be afraid. Perhaps I knew too much before, and then perhaps I found out too much during my first night with him. I don't remember. What a fool I was. When Father gave me the money and tried to talk me out of the thought of marriage, I would not listen. I thought of what the girls who were married had said of it, and I wanted marriage also. It wasn't Tom I wanted. It was marriage. When my father went to sleep, I leaned out of the window and thought of the life I had led. I didn't want to be a bad woman. The town was full of stories about me. I even began to be afraid Tom would change his mind." The woman's voice began to quiver with excitement. To Dr. Reefy,
who, without realizing what was happening, had begun to love her, there came an odd illusion. He thought that as she talked, the woman's body was changing, that she was becoming younger, straighter, stronger. When he could not shake off the illusion, his mind gave it a professional twist.
"It is good for both her body and her mind, this talking," he muttered.
The woman began telling of an incident that had happened one afternoon, a few months after her marriage. Her voice became steadier. "In the late afternoon, I went for a drive alone," she said. "I had a buggy and a little gray pony I kept at Moyer's livery. Tom was painting and repapering rooms in the hotel. He wanted money, and I was trying to make up my mind to tell him about the $800 father had given to me. I couldn't decide to do it. I didn't like him well enough. There was always paint on his hands and face during those days, and he smelled of paint. He was trying to fix up the old hotel and make it new and smart." The excited woman sat up very straight in her chair and made a quick girlish movement with her hand as she told of the drive alone on the spring afternoon. "It was cloudy and a storm threatened," she said. "Black clouds made the green of the trees and the grass stand out so that the colors hurt my eyes. I went out Trunnion Pike a mile or more and then turned into a side road. The little horse went quickly along up the hill and down. I was impatient. Thoughts came, and I wanted to get away from my thoughts. I began to beat the horse. The black cloud settled down and it began to rain. I wanted to go at a terrible speed, to drive on and on forever. I wanted to get out of town, out of my clothes, out of my marriage, out of my body, out of everything. I almost killed the horse, making him run. And when he could not run any more, I got out of the buggy and ran afoot into the darkness until I fell and hurt my side. I wanted to run away from everything, but I wanted to run towards something, too. Don't you see, dear, how it was?" Elizabeth sprang out of the chair and began to walk about in the office. She walked as Dr. Reefy thought he had never seen anyone walk before. To her whole body there was a swing, a rhythm that intoxicated him. When she came and knelt on the floor beside his chair, he took her into his arms and began to kiss her passionately. "I cried all the way home," she said, as she tried to continue the story of her wild ride, but he did not listen.
"You dear, you lovely dear, oh, you lovely dear," he muttered, and thought he held in his arms not the tired-out woman of 41,
but a lovely and innocent girl who had been able by some miracle to project herself out of the husk of the body of the tired old woman. Dr. Reefy did not see the woman he held in his arms again until after her death. On the summer afternoon in the office, when he was on the point of becoming her lover, a half-grotesque little incident brought his lovemaking quickly to an end. As the man and woman held each other tightly, heavy feet came tramping up the office stairs. The two sprang to their feet and stood listening and trembling. The noise on the stairs was made by a clerk from the Paris Dry Goods Company. With a loud bang, he threw an empty box on the pile of rubbish in the hallway, and then went heavily down the stairs. Elizabeth followed him almost immediately. The thing that had come to life in her as she talked to her one friend died suddenly. She was hysterical, as was also Dr. Reefy, and did not want to continue the talk. Along the street she went, with the blood still singing in her body. But when she turned out of Main Street and saw ahead the lights of the new Willard House, she began to tremble, and her knees shook, so that for a moment she thought she would fall in the street. The sick woman spent the last few months of her life hungering for death. Along the road of death she went, seeking, hungering. She personified the figure of death and made him now a strong black-haired youth running over hills, now a stern, quiet man marked and scarred by the business of living. In the darkness of her room she put out her hand, thrusting it from under the covers of her bed, and she thought that death, like a living thing, put out his hand to her.
Be patient, lover, she whispered. Keep yourself young and beautiful, and be patient.
On the evening when disease laid its heavy hand upon her and defeated her plans for telling her son George of the $800 hidden away, she got out of bed and crept half across the room, pleading with death for another hour of life.
Wait, dear, the boy, the boy, the boy,
she pleaded, as she tried with all of her strength to fight off the arms of the lover she had wanted so earnestly. Elizabeth died one day in March, in the year when her son George became 18, and the young man had but little sense of the meaning of her death. Only time could give him that. For a month he had seen her lying white and still and speechless in her bed, and then one afternoon the doctor stopped him in the hallway and said a few words. The young man went into his own room and closed the door. He had a queer, empty feeling in the region of his stomach. For a moment he sat staring at the floor, and then jumping up went for a walk. Along the station platform he went, and around through resident streets past the high school building, thinking almost entirely of his own affairs. The notion of death could not get hold of him, and he was, in fact, a little annoyed that his mother had died on that day. He had just received a note from Helen White, the daughter of the town banker, in answer to one from him.
Tonight I could have gone to see her. Now it will have to be put off,
he thought half angrily. Elizabeth died on a Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock. It had been cold and rainy in the morning, but in the afternoon the sun came out. Before she died, she lay paralyzed for 6 days, unable to speak or move, and with only her mind and her eyes alive. For 3 of the 6 days, she struggled, thinking of her boy, trying to say some few words in regard to his future, and in her eyes there was an appeal so touching that all who saw it kept the memory of the dying woman in their minds for years. Even Tom Willard, who had always half resented his wife, forgot his resentment, and the tears ran out of his eyes and lodged in his mustache. The mustache had begun to turn gray, and Tom colored it with dye. There was oil in the preparation he used for the purpose, and the tears, catching in the mustache and being brushed away by his hand, formed a fine, mist-like vapor. In his grief, Tom Willard's face looked like the face of a little dog that had been out a long time in bitter weather. George came home along Main Street at dark on the day of his mother's death, and after going to his own room to brush his hair and clothes, went along the hallway and into the room where the body lay. There was a candle on the dressing table by the door, and Dr. Reefy sat in a chair by the bed. The doctor arose and started to go out. He put out his hand as though to greet the younger man, and then awkwardly drew it back again. The air of the room was heavy with the presence of the two self-conscious human beings, and the man hurried away. The dead woman's son sat down in a chair and looked at the floor. He again thought of his own affairs, and definitely decided he would make a change in his life, that he would leave Winesburg.
I will go to some city. Perhaps I can get a job on some newspaper, he thought.
And then his mind turned to the girl with whom he was to have spent the evening, and again he was half angry at the turn of events that had prevented his going to her. In the dimly lighted room with the dead woman, the young man began to have thoughts. His mind played with thoughts of life as his mother's mind had played with the thought of death. He closed his eyes and imagined that the red young lips of Helen White touched his own lips. His body trembled and his hands shook. And then something happened. The boy sprang to his feet and stood stiffly. He looked at the figure of the dead woman under the sheets, and shame for his thoughts swept over him so that he began to weep. A new notion came into his mind, and he turned and looked guiltily about, as though afraid he would be observed. George Willard became possessed of a madness to lift the sheet from the body of his mother and look at her face. The thought that had come into his mind gripped him terribly. He became convinced that not his mother, but someone else lay in the bed before him. The conviction was so real that it was almost unbearable. The body under the sheets was long, and in death looked young and graceful. To the boy, held by some strange fancy, it was unspeakably lovely. The feeling that the body before him was alive, that in another moment a lovely woman would spring out of the bed and comfort him, became so overpowering that he could not bear the suspense. Again and again he put out his hand. Once he touched and half lifted the white sheet that covered her, but his courage failed, and he, like Dr. Reefy, turned and went out of the room. In the hallway outside the door, he stopped and trembled, so that he had to put a hand against the wall to support himself. "That's not my mother. That's not my mother in there," he whispered to himself, and again his body shook with fright and uncertainty. When Aunt Elizabeth Swift, who had come to watch over the body, came out of an adjoining room, he put his hand into hers and began to sob, shaking his head from side to side, half blind with grief. "My mother is dead," he said, and then, forgetting the woman, he turned and stared at the door through which he had just come. The dear, oh, the lovely dear! The boy, urged by some impulse outside himself, muttered aloud. As for the $800 the dead woman had kept hidden so long, and that was to give George Willard his start in the city, it lay in the tin box behind the plaster by the foot of his mother's bed. Elizabeth had put it there a week after her marriage, breaking the plaster away with a stick. Then she got one of the workmen her husband was at the time employing about the hotel to mend the wall. "I jammed the corner of the bed against it," she had explained to her husband, unable at the moment to give up her dream of release. The release that, after all, came to her but twice in her life, in the moments when her lovers, death, and Dr. Reefy held her in their arms. And those are our stories for this evening. I hope you enjoyed Drink and Death, from Winesburg, Ohio, by Sherwood Anderson. Thank you for listening. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time.